Hey, folks, is the WOW for Monday, August 20th. Mike Agovino here with Woody Overton. Grandpa Woody, how are you?
What's up, y'all? I'm doing well. Can't complain. Getting ready for football season this weekend. The college games kick off.
Isn't it amazing how fast that's happened?
The first two, at least. Anyway.
I know you're going to start us off with a really interesting football story. But before we do that, I know people are online talking again about the second episode in the Scorch series on the Lacey and Scott Peterson case. You got more coming this week. What about people that don't feel like waiting until Saturday? How can they get access?
They can, become a Patreon member or a convict in the app or Apple subscriber and get it commercial free early releases on it. I've already recorded several more episodes because y'all is so, I take such a deep dive into it and tell you the shit that, that they don't tell you in the documentaries. So, but yeah, they can do that. It's really, really, really interesting. And like I said, it's probably one of the worst cases of justice all the way around on both sides that I've ever seen.
Well, I know you're gonna talk about it in the episode this week or next week, I'm sure. But I'm always amazed that people who take bodies and anchor them or tie them up, do whatever, and put them in the water, that inevitably those bodies come up. What is it that people are missing or doing wrong?
I don't know.
These bodies come to the surface.
I go back to my love of crime when I was a kid, and the mafia and all of that, and they talk about putting cement boots on them and shit. Well, they always pop up. Your body will gas up, and eventually it'll rip away from the anchors, and it happens. And it just depends on water temperature and how hot it is outside, and that's how long it takes to do. That's not the way to do it, people. If you're going to do it, I'm not going to tell you how to do it because I might need to do it to you one day. I go, and then I'll be giving myself away.
You can do it in a kiddie pool with me.
If I'm going to get rid of a body, you're not going to find it. Yeah. If I'm going to get rid of a body, you're not going to find it. But let me tell you about our first story today. And I got to see this guy play college football at Alcorn State. When I was at Fort McCullen, Alabama, and when I was in the Army, it was like a leave thing. They got us tickets and we went and saw him, and he was just simply amazing. And when I'm talking about Steve, they call him Steve the Heir up there, McNair, right? So Netflix just, and I watched it, the first episode, Netflix released a new documentary, right, as part of its Untold series this week about the death of the former Tennessee Titan and Alcorn State star quarterback, Steve McNair. Steve McNair's life came to a tragic end when he was murdered by one of his mistresses in 2009. The acclaimed quarterback spent the majority of his football career playing for the Tennessee Titans, where he was named the NFL's most valuable player in 1999. And his life was brought to an end just 1 year after he retired from the NFL, y'all. And officially, McNair was killed at the hands of his girlfriend, Shayo Jenny Kazemi, what they thought was a murder-suicide. Now, McNair, who had been married to his wife, Michelle, since 1997, he began having an affair with Kazemi in early 2009. At the time, she was 19 years old and a waitress at Dave & Buster's in Nashville, or some of the Titan players hung out. Have you ever been to Dave & Buster's?
Oh, I've been to many. I'm a big Dave and Buster's fan. Big Dave and Buster's fan.
That really, 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 really cool place. I've gone with cops a lot of times in a lot of different states on polygraph conventions and stuff like that. And good food and good beer and fun places to hang out. But so the Titan players were hanging out there, and he met this 19-year-old, and she had immigrated to the U.S. As a teenager, after her mother was murdered in her home country of Iran. And she moved from Florida to Tennessee with a boyfriend when she was 16. But by December 2008, they had split up. And that's not totally true. They were still living together, but they split up. And later that same month, she had met Steve McNair. And they began seeing each other often, spending time at a condo in Nashville that McNair rented with a friend for times he wanted to spend away from his family, basically a cat house. And McNair and Kazemi started seeing each other. That's what it is, a lay pad, yep, whatever you want to call it. But a lot of the rich people that I've dealt with, and when I used to do this private consulting stuff across the United States, they had separate homes for these nefarious reasons, I guess you would say. But anyway, if you're married, so despite being married, and his relationship with Kazemi seemed to grow more serious over time. And her family says she told them McNair was planning on leaving his wife and would marry her. I'm probably pretty sure that's not true. Kazemi's sister, Sepeda Salamani, said just weeks before her sister's death, she had told her that McNair's divorce was being finalized. But Kazemi also had suspicions that McNair was secretly seeing another woman. And on top of that, Kazemi had mounting financial problems. Now, while McNair told her he was getting a divorce, he still lived at home with his wife, Michelle, and the kids. So Michelle later revealed that she had no plans to divorce Steve and had no idea about his affair with Kazemi. At the same time, McNair was actually having an affair with another woman named Leah. He loves these names. Ignani, whom he had met several months prior. Now, Kazemi discovered that McNair was likely also seeing another woman because she found used condoms in the bathroom of his condo. Well, there you go. So Ignati later told police that she had noticed the Cadillac Escalade following her on several occasions, suggesting that Kazemi knew who McNair was having an affair with. Now, Kazemi was arrested on July 2nd on DUI charges, and McNair bailed her out of jail, and they argued after that, right? After parting ways, McNair went to see Ignati before opening his restaurant for the morning. That night, he returned to Ignati's home to the sleepover. And on July 3rd, Kazemi had a lengthy text message conversation with McNair, who was fishing with his sons. She expressed concerns over finances, telling him she had cell phone and hospital bills to pay, in addition to car payments on Escalade and an older vehicle she owned. McNair agreed to transfer her $2,000 because Kazemi continued to be upset and floated the idea of going to the hospital to get checked out. After asking McNair to meet her that night, Kazemi headed to her shift at Dave & Buster's. Now, before clocking in, she met up with Adrian Gilliam, a convicted felon she had met while trying to sell her old car. In the restaurant's parking lot, Gilliam sold Kazemi a 9mm handgun. Now, Kazemi was acting strange during her shift and told her manager, Sonia, that my life is just shit and I should end it. When she left work, Kazemi texted McNair to ask him if he wanted to go out drinking. He declined, saying he was busy putting his kids to bed, although he told his friend Doug Crow he would meet up with him. Instead of going out, Kazemi decided to go to McNair's condo. Meanwhile, McNair was out with Crow, but only stayed at the bar briefly before texting Kazemi at 12:38 a.m. to tell her he was on the way to the condo. Now, McNair's driver dropped him off sometime between 1:15 and 1:30 a.m., and he would be the last person to see McNair alive. At around 12:40 p.m. on July 4th, Wayne Neely, McNair's friend, whom he rented the condo with, stopped by. When he walked inside, he discovered two bodies, although he claims not to recognize who it was. I thought that was suspicious. But within minutes, Neely left the apartment to call McNair's longtime friend and business partner, Robert Gaddy, around 12:50 p.m. to tell him what he had found. Once Gaddy arrived, they entered the condo together, and he immediately knew one of the bodies was McNair. And at 1:35 p.m., Gaddy goes outside and calls 911. And what do authorities believe happened to Steve McNair? Authorities rule the death of McNair and Kazemi a murder-suicide. Based on the evidence, investigators concluded that at some point in the early hours of July 4th, McNair fell asleep on the couch and Kazemi shot him multiple times while he was unconscious. She shot him on the left side of his head from a few feet away, then twice in the chest, and another on the right side of his head at a closer range. Then Kazemi sat down next to McNair, shot herself in the right side of the head, and collapsed onto his lap. This was part of the police. She eventually fell on the floor on top of the gun where she was found the following morning. Now, investigators deduced that Kazemi had become overwhelmed by her mounting financial struggles and a state of a relationship with McNair after discovering he was having an affair with another woman. Sounds like a clean rap, right? Well, lots of questions still remain surrounding Steve McNair's death. Y'all can catch it on the documentary on Netflix.
God, I mean, it's so weird to me that a guy who was such a classy, courageous player, he was a great teammate, he was beloved by the fans, he seemingly had a great family, that his off-the-field behavior was in such stark contrast to who he was as a player. I mean, here he is, he's got multiple places and he's juggling multiple women just a year after playing. I mean, it's crazy the life he was living.
Yeah, I can assure you he was living that life the whole time he was playing too. He didn't just start when he retired, but it is what it is. I mean, you know, you choose how you want to live, and maybe his wife, Michelle, put up with it because, you know, the meal ticket. I don't know. Maybe she didn't know. I don't know about that either. I don't know how you don't know, but it happens. So, but I don't know about just her killing, you know, being a murder suicide. We'll see how it turns out.
Yeah. There are some things there that make you scratch your head for sure. So check it out. And maybe at some point, Woody, that would be a good one. I know you were talking about doing a series on some of these sports related murders. That'd be a good one to dig.
Deeper into. Cool. Interesting story.
Okay, well, we are on the dawn of football season. We just did a football story, and now we're going to turn our attention to Penn State and our Nittany Lion series. This is episode 9, and it follows episode 9, which is actually a 3-part episode within the With the Benefit of Hindsight series. You probably noticed that just part 1 was a 4+ hour ordeal as we start rolling through the testimonies in the Sandusky trial. So this is the show, and the next couple, maybe we could wrap it up in the next one. We will go through the testimonies in the order they were given and everything that happened in the trial. So let's talk about the lead up to the trial. As we've said a number of times, Sandusky gets arrested in November of 2011, and by June of 2012, the trial is taking place. That is a very short time period. It's not unprecedented, but there are reasons that things can happen that fast, and there are also reasons why things maybe get manipulated to make it happen that fast. It's certainly Ziegler's stance and mine that things are manipulated in order to get that trial to take place so quickly. And we'll go through a couple of those. But the unique circumstances surrounding this case, which we've talked about every week throughout, really impact Sandusky's opportunity to get a free trial. This was the number one news story in the country for the entire time period between his arrest and the trial. And so you're talking about a massive amount of coverage that the public is getting hit with in this case. And the that had on Sandusky's right to be innocent until proven guilty was just, it can't be overstated. The firing of Paterno, the firing of Spanier, the firing of Schultz, the firing of Curley, all of those things, which were done by the Penn State Board of Trustees, were indications to people in the community that Sandusky must be guilty. Candlelight vigil before the big Nebraska game, the prayer at midfield before that game. Later in March of 2012, the Board of Trustees sponsors a forum on child sex abuse, referring to the tragedy at Penn State. There continues to be, as I said, an unprecedented amount of coverage. You know, this is happening at about the time that the pendulum is swinging in the United States. This is immediately post the Catholic Church scandal, and probably for years, the presumption of innocence had the pendulum on side, and victims were challenged and not believed, and the church scandal happens, and the pendulum swings to the other side. And really, I think impacts any presumption of innocence that, that Sandusky would have had. Sandusky himself and his wife, Dottie, Ziegler describes as delusional. And I think that's the correct description. They were delusional. They were these God-fearing, massively religious couple that just believed that Jesus would take care of things. They thought that the community of State College and the Penn State community would be on Jerry's side because he had done so much for the university over all of the years. Because of that, he's convinced that he doesn't need a venue change. They don't request a venue change. Sandusky wants the trial to be held. They give up the right to a preliminary hearing. And so Sandusky is convinced by his attorney, who we'll get into in a minute, that he doesn't need a preliminary hearing, which would have put the state's case on full display for them so they could really get an understanding of what the state had as far as evidence, but they give up the right to that.
The preliminary hearing, I always say, is a free shot for the defense to find out exactly what the prosecution has. And again, it's going to come up here in a minute. He had the dumbest fucking lawyer in the world to do that. Why would you do that? Why would you give up the chance to find out everything that they have? They're going to put the preliminary hearing basically is like a mini trial. They're going to put the witnesses up there, the cops and stuff, and say, why is this way? They didn't do that. That is just dumb. I've never heard anybody do it.
And the various rationales I've heard for Amendola's recommendation to Sandusky that they not do it, none of them have made any sense to me over the years. This was a tragic error.
If one was to believe your theory that all these people colluded to basically butt fuck Sandusky, then I would say that Amendola was in on it. If I believed your theory that all these people did it, then Amendola, there's no way he's that dumb. He had to be in.
I don't think Amendola was, quote, in on anything other than, I think he was in on understanding that nobody wanted to see him do a great job here except Sandusky. It was clear to him that he was supposed to lose gracefully.
Well, then he's in on it. Because, if he was good defense attorney, he wouldn't give a fuck what anybody else thought. He would do his best job.
Well, and you hear Ziegler throughout talk about his belief that Amendola is an honest man who was just completely overmatched and trying to take on Goliath with him being David and just had not the experience, the skill, the resourcing to compete against what he was up against. Anyway, they don't ask for the preliminary hearing. They go ahead and ask for a continuance because they receive something like 140 boxes of evidence, every evidence from the state just 3 weeks before the trial is supposed to begin. Amendola approaches Judge Cleland and asks for a continuance. The judge refuses the request. And subsequent to that, Amendola requests to be allowed to withdraw from the case because he says, I cannot do a quality job for my client. I can't even get through all of this evidence that has been provided to us. I don't have the resources to do it, and you're not giving me the time to do it. The judge, again, refuses. And so he first tries to get a continuance, then tries to get removed from the case, and he strikes out on both. And you might say, well, why is there such a hurry to get to trial? And remember, Penn State football is big, big business. It's the biggest business in that part of the state by far. There's a possibility hanging over this program that they could get the death sentence that that SMU received from the NCAA for their violations. They could potentially lose their football program. And so behind the scenes, Penn State, through the board, with some help from the governor, with some help from Lewis Free, who they have hired to do this investigation to validate slash exonerate the Board of Trustees for their actions in firing Paterno and Spanier and Schultz and Curley. All of them are discussing this all the way through. They know they need a quick trial and a conviction because they got a football season that really begins in August. I mean, you don't play games really until September, but you better be on the field practicing in August. So they've got to have this exoneration for the Board of Trustees through the free report. They've got to have a consent decree finalized along with the program sanctions from the NCAA. They've got to be able to protect their coaches, their players, their relationship with the conference, their schedule, their TV rights, all sorts of things are hanging in the balance in order for Penn State to have a 2012 season. And make no mistake about it, having that season means hundreds of millions of dollars to the university, and it's a state-run university. It means hundreds of millions of dollars to the state. So the governor and the Board of Trustees cannot afford for the 2012 season, or the program especially, to be destroyed.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that doesn't turn into fat when you consume it. Instead, it turns into a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body.
So getting more MCTs in your diet is like flipping a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which flushes out excess fat and calories. And Dr. Gundry has created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it comes in a tasty drink form. It actually tastes good. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized.
So if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/RLRC and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. And again, that's GundryMD.com/RLRC.
Awesome.
All right, good deal.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with a subject?
Now.
Is your child ahead,
real life,
not getting challenged enough in class?
Get an exclusive
IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool curriculum. It offers practice in math, English,
today.
Language arts, visit science, and social studies while adopting
today
to each child,
to get the most
meeting them where they are.
Program
plus,
out there
IXL
at the best
encourages
price.
Students to be curious and empowers them how to choose to learn. Now, Cindy used IXL in the classroom as a teacher and now uses it to homeschool our youngest son in the 9th grade. The videos are what she finds that benefits him most in math because he's a very visual learner. The perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum, IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational game lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving, and everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. Instant grading, helpful progress reporting. IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Flexible and personalized. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. It's fun for kids, and kids love IXL's positive feedback, awards, and educational games. And it's trustworthy. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
So the defense has no time to prepare for this trial, but it happens nonetheless.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, it wouldn't have gone to trial in 7 months had they had the preliminary hearing, because they have the preliminary hearing, then the judge has to, most of the time, on smaller things like drug charges and stuff like that, the judge can rule immediately. But a lot of times they may say, okay, I'll come back in next month and give you my ruling on whatever the things are they would have presented at the preliminary hearing, but they didn't do that. And then he comes back and says, oh, well, I need more help, blah, blah, blah. And the judge is like, well, go fuck yourself. And then they didn't ask for the change of venue, which would have taken more time and given it more time to go through stuff and what have you. But that's what appeals are for. And if I was Sandusky, one of the things I would have brought up on appeal is, hey, that judge didn't give me the resources. I got what they call a document dump 3 weeks before the trial, which is actually, that's a very, very common thing that's done all the time. You know, prosecution playing defense games. And that's it. I mean, I don't know if it's so much, though. I think certainly the season coming up is a big deal. I mean, college football is huge. Like LSU brings just a phenomenal amount of money for every game, especially the home games. But I think they wanted it to go away, period, for not only football reasons, but for the image of the university.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, for all of these reasons, they wanted to get it in the rearview mirror as fast as they could get it in the rearview mirror.
Right.
And I also agree with you that had they had the preliminary hearing, that would have taken, backed up the trial by a considerable amount of time. And it's just, it boggles the mind how a decision was made not to do that.
Yeah.
No idea how they could have made that decision, but they did. And then you've got what happens in voir dire. So there are three significant, I would say, mistakes, and they're not just mistakes by Amendola. They're, again, delusional mistakes that Sandusky makes, where Sandusky is still convinced at this point that the community, that Jesus, that they're not going to let this happen to him. He still thinks up until the end that there are a number of these accusers that aren't going to be able to go through with this. And so during voir dire, who is married to a doctor who worked for Dr. Dranov, who is the McQueary family friend who Mike went to the night he supposedly saw Sandusky in the shower with Alan Myers, victim number two. She told Zig in a direct conversation that she didn't think she could be objective. She knew the McQueary family well. She had positive feelings about the family and about Mike. Amendola rejected her, but the judge said no. But then Amendola had an opportunity to use a peremptory strike, and with conversation with Sandusky, they decided not to.
I mean, again, that goes back on them. That's why you have the, so I'm still going to bring you to a voir dire so you all understand that they when they put these people on these panels and they question them individually, do you know anybody in this case? Do you believe you can be objective or what? And a lot of people are like, no, fuck no, I can't be objective for whatever reason. This lady, you know, because she knew the McQueary family. But then the judge was, when she says that, the judge would ask her specifically, does that mean that you can't come into this courtroom and sit here and listen to all the evidence? Because you know this family, you can't listen to all the evidence and make up your own mind. And they'll say what they say. And then just say, you think this is going to cause you some undue hardship in the rest of your life because you have the relationship with this family, if you come back and you find it the opposite way that the family is thinking. And so, I mean, they really questioned him hard on it, but fucking Amendola should have used a strike. I mean, that's why you have him. I mean, and that's on him.
Could not agree more. And then there was another one where it was actually a Penn State student who is asked by Amendola, if he were to find that Sandusky was innocent, would he be able to go back and face his roommates after having made the not guilty decision? And the guy says, that's not a problem because I'd never have to tell them that.
Right.
In other words, I'm not going to find him not guilty. So, he's guilty, right?
On Courtney Coco's trial, Darren Boisdier, which was it was all about real life, real crime and me, right? And one of the panels they brought in and they were asking, the podcast, Woody Overton, how do you feel about it? And the guy said, he's guilty as hell. And you're never going to make me believe otherwise because Woody Overton's a shit. And the judge is like, you're excused.
I was going to say, you're not going to tell me that guy got on the jury. No, he didn't get on the jury. Okay.
But
that is incredible though. So, but same thing happens here.
Yeah.
Where Amendola wants him excused, Cleland refuses, and they don't use a strike. And then the third one is the trial is happening in June. Remember, the Free report comes out in July. And so the Free investigators have been in the field investigating people throughout the spring. And a woman is in the jury pool who had already been interviewed by the Free group investigators. And she apparently had big issues with the Penn State administrators for one reason or another. And again, we repeat the same thing. Request to the judge refuses, Amendola and Sandusky sidebar, and they decide that they're not going to use a strike.
Got a little bit wrong there because it's not how it works. This person makes a statement or whatever, the prosecution gets to vote to keep them on or to use a strike. The defense the same way, but the judge has an unlimited amount of strikes that they can use, right? So it doesn't matter if they have a sidebar or not. Dollar is going to be bad for Sandusky. They should have struck him. I mean, now you only get so many strikes, but they should have struck him, but they didn't. So it's back again, Sandusky and him.
Yeah, no, that's what I meant. Maybe I phrased that wrong, but that's what happened. So you're going to trial with those three. And again, the other nine are all people from this community because Sandusky didn't want a change of venue. So this is what you've got, people from this community. And Ziegler makes a big deal in the episode. And I'm not really on board with this as much, where, it was the community that was on trial. It was State College, Pennsylvania, because it was the entire community that had protected a pedophile perceptually, et cetera. I don't know about that. What I know is you got a jury pool that has heard a tremendous amount about this story. You have a jury pool that ultimately, which we'll talk about later, is not sequestered. They are living their normal life outside of court during a case that was just incredibly publicized. So moving forward, by trial, we now have 10 total accusers. So remember, at arrest, we had 8. So 2 have now been added. If you remember, Detective Anthony Sassano had made the statements to Prosecutor Janelle Eschbach that once they arrest Sandusky, they will get a flood of new accusers to come forward. And Ziegler makes a point that I think is a very credible one, that during this time period where they have the opportunity to vet all of these new accusers that supposedly come forward, they choose 2. And we'll talk about one of those to today. We'll talk about the other one next week, but each of them, in my opinion, their stories are absurd. And so for you to arrest the man, and now it is open season, bring your complaint forward, get on the line as a witness, you can remain anonymous, and a bunch of people come forward with stories. And these are the two stories that are accepted and added to the case, and yet the stories are ridiculous, but we'll get into those. So the the defense asked for dates of the allegations from all of the victims, and the judge denied. So you're trying, if you're Sandusky and what has happened, what has played out in public has really put you in a position where you have got to prove your innocence. This is not about you're presumed innocent and the prosecution has to prove your guilt. Everyone assumes you are guilty. The university has made all of these maneuvers, all of these terminations, all of these actions they've taken, all of which presume they would never take from the public's perception unless you were guilty. So the entire world, including all of us watching this unfold and hearing about it in our news, assumes this man's guilt. The only chance he has at trial is to absolutely prove his innocence. And every turn, he's blocked from things that might have helped prove his innocence.
They could have got all this information. First of all, it would have been in the document dump anyway. But secondly, had they done the preliminary hearing, they could have asked the arresting detective specifically what victim was done on what date. And if they didn't have it, then they could have used that. But again, they chose not to do a preliminary hearing.
Yeah, look, Amendola's incompetence or whatever you want to experience, lack of resources, the incompetence of the defense team for Sandusky, and by the way, the original appeal for Sandusky included laundry lists of incompetence of counsel issues.
As it should have.
Like the one you are talking about. But they're not getting dates. Woody, we talked about, and I think it was a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about the lack of porn. There was no porn found Sandusky's home, his office, his electronic devices, anywhere. And I think you said that it happens a good portion of the time, but there's like 40% of the time where nothing like that is found. I went through our research, and we went through hundreds of cases, modern cases. We didn't go back past 1980 or so, and didn't find a single case where there was not pornography of one kind or another, either physical pictures.
Let me explain it to you, guy. Okay. All the information that you went through on people who were arrested, these pedophiles are arrested that also had child pornography of some type on them, right? But how can you research pedophiles that were arrested that didn't have pornography? Because it's not going to be listed. You understand what I'm saying? The cases I work on, people that arrested for molestation and whatever, if they didn't have it, it's not listed. You don't charge them with it. And there's certainly a certain percentage of cases that people don't have porn in. And the other thing on that is, Sandusky is supposed to be computer illiterate. For you to get child porn, you got to get on the dark net. You can't just go to your local drug dealer and say, give me some kiddie porn. All right. You got to use onion browsers. You got to be somewhat adept in how to get into these things that can't be tracked. And then that you don't just get it. Those people, they it's like a bartering system. Like, okay, I'll trade you some. You give me some years, right? Otherwise, you might be a cop. And I'm talking about, it's pretty in-depth knowledge on how to get into the dark net, right? And you just can't go to the dark net and search child porn. Somebody's got to give you whatever the address site is, to go into and all that. It takes a lot. As you're saying, Sandusky's in his 60s and not computer literate or whatever, then it's totally understandable that he didn't have child porn. I mean, it just is. And again, back to every case that you've researched, that you found that they had child porn, they had child porn. They're not going to list a case of someone that has child porn, even though they're a pedophile, that has child porn if it's not there. So those numbers aren't there. They're never been reported. You understand what I'm saying?
But I don't think you're understanding what I'm saying. We looked at every conviction. Right. So the only way what you're saying makes sense is if those people weren't convicted. Well, if they weren't convicted, they're not guilty.
They're not convicted of child porn. It doesn't mean that you're telling me every uncle that molests their niece. No. Tell me every pedophile and that since the beginning of time has child porn. That's bullshit. I know it from personal experience. You haven't worked these cases. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. Yes, certainly it happens. Certainly if it's in part of the FBI profile on pedophiles, but it's not every one of them. It's just not. I mean, I'll give you double clutch. Over 40 victims that we found, and he'd been doing it over 20 years. Not one iota of porn. Now, he had like Penthouse magazine shit, but he didn't have any kiddie porn.
Well, but that would qualify. So
porn, yeah, everybody has porn. Fuck,
who Jerry Sandusky did not have any.
And when Jerry came up,
they went so far.
Wait, look,
they went so far out of their way.
The first porn that I looked at, I was like, I was a teenager. There was no internet, anything like that. I had to stand in line at some small convenience store. I was embarrassed and had to wait for everybody to leave and go up and say, give me that magazine up there off the thing. And it was wrapped in a brown wrapper and they gave it to me. I didn't know what fucking magazine it was. And it turned out to be something called Jugs about lactating breast or something. But I was like 12 years old right. And I wanted a dirty magazine. We didn't have the internet. And everybody has access to Google it. And erase it now. I mean, and I can't imagine shit. Playboy wasn't even around magazine probably when Sandusky was coming up. You know, what kind of porn it started in the 60s. And that's not really even like
no, but here, but porn. No, Woody, this is a really, really important part of this case. Yeah. That
love you to death. We are never going to agree. We are never going to agree that every pedophile has child porn. That's not. It doesn't happen, and it's not true. I don't care how much research you've done. Go research my cases because I can tell you that at least 40% of them that didn't have porn, and I searched their send in their computers. I'm not saying porn. I'm talking about child porn, illegal shit that you go to prison for.
Okay. So remember the time frame that Sandusky was supposedly this mastermind abuser during, right? It's the mid-90s essentially to the end of the 2000s, right? So the coming of age of the internet and then the internet, it was before the dark internet. If think of the biggest goody two shoes goof at your high school or at college that you went to school with, the guy who never did anything wrong in his life. And that's who this guy is. He had never seen any.
Okay.
In his life.
I'm not saying that he did. Sex is 99% mental. If he's got an unlimited supply of kids from the second mile, he doesn't need any fucking porn. And you stuck on the porn thing. It's not fucking true. I mean, for whatever reason, I'm not saying he had porn. For whatever reason, he didn't have it. I mean, you can't base this whole case and throw it out as saying that, oh, he never looked at kiddie porn. Because there are a lot of people that offend that don't look at children's porn. And you'll never make me believe otherwise. So move on past that point.
Just to be clear, my comment wasn't about child porn. My comment was about porn, period. Number one. Number two, I'm not saying it's the only reason. Look, this is a case, in my opinion, where there are 200 things you can look at. Any one of them separated from the other 199. You can make a case on both sides of. But in order to understand and see Sandusky as somebody who actually did what he was accused of, you have to look at 200 things and every one of them has to fall on the side of, or at least the vast majority of them have to fall on the side that makes no logical sense.
Every case is different. Every perpetrator is different. Hey, you know what? Did they find an old Sears and Roebuck catalog or an old National Geographic? Maybe Jerry beat his meat to that. I'm not saying everybody that uses porn, Mike. I'm saying you can't make this fit and say he's not a pedophile and he didn't offend because he didn't have porn. I mean, it's not the real world, man. And
okay. I'll go a step further and tell you that I'm not going to argue with you anymore about never, that. Never even masturbated.
Yeah. Okay.
But
okay.
We can.
Sure he did. Yeah.
Never even.
Sure he did. And when I was in the ninth grade, I got into a fist fight with a boy because he told me I did. And I assured him that I didn't. And I beat his ass and I was lying. All right. And so you talk about the biggest goody tissue in high school or whatever. Fuck them. They have a sexual drive too. Everybody has a sexual drive. Everybody that you see on the face of this earth got here because two people screwed. And everybody has a sexual drive. Period.
The prosecution decides to lead the trial off with Brett Hoetz, who is victim number four. This is the kid that ends up on with the cops that end up with the lawyer on the recording during the interview, if you remember from last episode, right? So you would think, I think most people would think, that since this story from the get-go has been about Aaron Fisher, that Aaron Fisher would be the first victim to testify at trial, but it's not. It's Brett Hoetz, who is number four. So his accusations are that Sandusky abused him during trips to bowl games. So Sandusky, with his wife, would take one, sometimes several, second milers along with them on trips to bowl games that Penn State was playing in. Now, Sandusky is the defensive coordinator of this team during this time that we are talking about. So He is a very busy man preparing a defense for a bowl game and practicing in advance of that bowl game. Brett Hoetz's story evolves to the point where he claims that Dottie walked in on him and Jerry having sex in the hotel room. So the very first accuser is now placing Dottie Sandusky, from a credibility standpoint, the only choice you have as a juror at that point is either to believe that she's as horrible as her husband because she knew all this was going on, it happened in front of her, and she did nothing about it and stood by his side, or maybe the little old lady that goes to church 50 times a week isn't a pedophile protector, and maybe this kid is full of shit.
Maybe Sandusky is such a mastermind that he played her too. Okay, what if the dog's ass was glass and it broke every time he jumped? You maybe anything to death. But go ahead.
He's such a mastermind that he convinced her the sex she saw him having with this kid in a hotel room, it was not sex.
That's not what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying if this went on for all these years, that she was either so ignorant or a combination of her ignorance and him being the mastermind and like him controlling these kids for the rest of their lives or trying to be an influence for the rest of their lives to make sure they don't tell. But go ahead.
Okay. So there's a woman by the name of Elaine Steinbacher, who has a Penn Stater and has known the family for years. She testified that Hoetz came to Sandusky home with his girlfriend and his son for dinner because he wanted Jerry to meet his son long after this abuse supposedly took place. She also testified that she was threatened by Joe McGettigan. By the way, there are a number, including Joe McGettigan and Frank Fina, of prosecutors in this case who lose their law licenses over their actions in this case. McGettigan is, there's a laundry list of things he did. But he told Elaine Steinbacher, you might want to think about your kids and your grandkids if you're going to testify at trial.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Houtz's own mother testified and called him a liar. The bombshell of Houtz going out for having that cigarette during his interview with police, where the lawyer, which why does he have a lawyer at that point, all he's doing is being interviewed by the police about whether Jerry Sandusky abused him. The recording is still going on. The attorney asks the investigators if they can tell him that there are a number of other people who have testified that Sandusky has abused him, when at that point in time, the only thing they had was two failed attempts by Aaron Fisher to give a grand jury testimony that made any sense. Lied to this guy, telling him there were other victims in order to get him to claim to be a victim. He becomes a victim. He teams up with the same therapist as Aaron Fisher. So now he's under Mike Gillum's watch. In the book Silent No More that Gillum co-wrote with Aaron Fisher, he tells the story of Houtz approaching Fisher in front of the courthouse and, you know, making sure that that Fisher is going to testify. Zig's theory of that whole discussion is revealed. And again, it's a discussion. You could take it a number of ways. Is Houtz worried about, you know, Fisher not being able to perform like he was in the grand jury, or is he making sure that he's got the balls to bullshit? Whichever way you want to see it, you can see it. The judge admonishes the jury after the recording is played with the cops and tells them that they are to use that not to judge the testimony of Houtz, but only the credibility of the investigators. That's another appeal item, but the testimony is perceived as a big deal for the prosecution when the story makes absolutely no sense. Houtz talks about creepy love letters that Sandusky has sent to him. There's a number of them that are read during this time period. They, again, if you want to try and read into these letters something nefarious, you can do it. Sandusky at a point in one of the letters says to Houtz that you only care when you can impress some young lady. And that was taken as an indication of Sandusky's jealousy that Houtz was seeing women. But if you look at what Sandusky wrote, not only to Houtz, but to all these kids, as well as many other kids who didn't claim that he abused them, they are notes that come from someone who truly cares about your development, about who you're becoming as a person, how you're going to live your life. The one used during Houtz's testimony included these excerpts. Your word means nothing. You have no appreciation. You have no loyalty. You have no work ethic. You are faltering in school. There is no substance to your agreements. You live moment to moment. He's trying to motivate a kid that he feels is beginning to fail. But prosecutors see all this as jealousy and creepy love letters, rather than a man who's been an inspiration to hundreds of kids trying to inspire Houtz to do better than he is doing. And again, this is, you can go through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters that Sandusky wrote. And if you go through them objectively, they are obviously not letters that are sexual in any way, shape, or form. They are a fatherly figure who cares, I mean, unnaturally. He cares so much about these kids, and he built this charity to, in his father's name, to try and help all of these kids growing up in poverty to have a chance for a better life. And he was seen as by the overwhelming majority of them, all the ones who didn't take the easy money that was being offered to step up and lie. And so Houtz testimony should have been seen as the BS that it was, but it wasn't.
I was sitting here and I'm just, you're making your own point, Mike, the when you come out and you say that, you know, this, he's this hero, da 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 da. But after mentioning the jealousy, that's your interpretation. That's Zig's interpretation of those letters. That obviously other people saw it a different way. And you know, that's it. That's all I have to say about it. I mean, you certainly believe what you believe. And I give you that. All right. But I'm telling you, as is proven by the convictions, other people saw it.
Absolutely nothing is proven by the convictions, as we see every day in the United States of America today. I mean,
every conviction in the United States of America is wrong, right?
Yeah. No, not every, Woody, not every conviction, but a lot of them. And in this case, you have not a single contemporaneous complaint. You have not a single victim who the first time they spoke to police said Sandusky ever did anything to him. The entire thing was orchestrated by two mothers who came forward looking for paydays. It's, you know, I'm frankly shocked that we're at the point we are, and it's, and you're fighting me so hard on these things. But let's go to Aaron Fisher.
You won't even give it a thought. You know, you just, like you said about these two moms, they're just looking for paydays. You want to give it a thought that they might actually have believed that their kids were offended against. And yeah, they were looking for paydays. But because in your mind, Jerry Sandusky has never done anything. He's a saint and he's never masturbated. He's never done anything. He's never done anything wrong his entire life. He's a saint, right? So everything that you are saying is I get why you're saying it, because you believe that. But obviously, and you're saying, you know, juries get it wrong every day. Sure, some cases they do. That's been proved to DNA and stuff like that. But it's better than...
Let me ask you something, because I don't understand it. Ziegler never understood it. Maybe you can tell me why and how. But why all of these accusations thrown together in one case, like this is a RICO trial, instead of there being individual cases involved?
It'll never be a RICO trial. Racketeering influence and corruption organization, right? That's an ongoing criminal enterprise that makes money. That was brought in to give stiffer penalties to the mafia and gangs and shit like that. That has nothing to do with a pedophile. What was your question?
Why is it
all tried together?
Why aren't there 9 separate trials instead of one, or 10 separate trials
Why would there be? Why would you spend 9 times the money trying to shit 9 different times when all of this is case? Whether some of these victims are telling the truth or not, this case is a puzzle, right? Whether you believe them or don't, this case is a puzzle that has to be told. You can't just bring in one. Why would you bring in one when you've allegedly have 9 or 10 or whatever it is, and it goes to prove the whole behavior of Sandusky, if you will, what the whole criminality of the situation. Why would you try it? It doesn't make sense to try it independently. Then that's their cases, and that they brought these charges all together at one time, and certainly that's part of the legal system, and they could do that if they want. But go ahead.
Well, I still don't understand how they can do that.
Sandusky, super cases. John Wayne Gacy's got 27 bodies in his yard. Why would you try him for each individual body? Why wouldn't you put it all together? Doesn't make any sense, Mike.
Why are they separated sometimes and sometimes not? I don't know.
That's prosecution and defense. Okay. and the judge. That's not for me to say.
Okay. But do you agree with me that if each of these were taken, if we just take your pick, take Aaron Fisher, take Brett Holtz, take the McQueary story, take whichever one you want, and say there's a separate individual trial on that case, Does Sandusky get convicted?
I think there's a chance that on some of them, certainly, whether it's the memory part or they get money later on, whatever it may be, certainly some of them look shady, right? But then you put them all together. This is a circumstantial case. You got to put all the circumstances together. You put it together and you let a jury decide what they believe is credible or not. And if they,
After you lie to the public and say that somebody saw Sandusky having anal sex with a boy who might have been as young as eight years old in a shower, after you tell that lie, then you put all these people together that have been incentivized by millions of dollars where they can be anonymous and create whatever fantasy stories they want to create. Let's take Fisher. Okay. He's the second to testify, even though he was the first victim, right? Now his story is completely different. It's changed from anything he's delivered to the grand jury or anything before. Now it's over 100 times that he has been abused by Sandusky. It's his fourth time testifying, and he can't give dates as to when anything happened. One of his timelines includes 2009. He says he was abused by Sandusky in 2009. He brought the complaint forward in 2008. Did he think Sandusky was still abusing him a year later in 2009? In fact, we bring forward proof that his mother was using Dottie Sandusky as a babysitter in 2009, because this whole thing was a fishing expedition for her. She didn't want to lose the benefits of a relationship with the Sandusky family if it wasn't going to go anywhere. And so she was maintaining a relationship with the Sanduskys until it finally came out in the leak in March of 11 that it was Aaron, that there was a grand jury investigation and it was Aaron Fisher. People in the community didn't know what was being said. We, in this episode, air an interview with Brian Mock, who's the father of a kid who was Aaron's best friend when he was younger, whose home Aaron slept at many, many times. Aaron's major ration, his case made on the stand about his abuse, a big part of it was that the abuse under Jerry caused him to start wetting the bed. Well, we know from Brian Mock that he was wetting the bed his entire life. That wasn't true. We also find out from Mock that his mother didn't give a shit about him. She was always out drinking. We've got all of her Facebook posts. She is out drinking all of the time. She's not taking care of her son. He's sleeping at all of these other kids' house. Mock's son went to Sandusky's house with Aaron. Nothing strange happened or anything like that. Judy Fox, who put together a fundraiser for Aaron Fisher when his book came out, was told by Dawn that these gifts from Sandusky were used as evidence that he was grooming Aaron Fisher with lavish gifts. Well, Dawn confesses to Judy Fox that Joe McGettigan fabricated the whole thing with the gifts, that it wasn't true, that Dottie did buy some church clothes for Aaron because the Sanduskys wanted to bring him to church with them and he didn't have any suitable church clothes. So they did get him church clothes. And there was a computer that was going to be thrown out by Penn State that they did give to him, an old computer ready for the garbage heap and some church clothes. But McGettigan is telling stories of much larger gifts. Aaron claimed that he was abused in the pool at the Hilton Garden Inn by Jerry Sandusky. The pool at the Hilton Garden Inn has windows onto it from every direction of the hotel. There's not a thing that can go on in that pool that isn't seen by everyone in the hotel. Aaron even says, regarding all the changes in his story, quote, "With everything I was trying to forget, it was hard to remember. I might have told some white lies."
Okay. It's obvious, and I said this before, that some of the shit he has is definitely shady. But do you think every single thing this boy said, every single thing is a lie?
I think the only things he said that were not a lie was that Jerry would put his arm around him, that Jerry would put his hand on his knee when they were in a car together, that Jerry would crack his back for wrestling. I think those things are true because
I'm talking about any of the sexual accusations. Do you think there are?
No.
Everyone, okay.
But not a chance.
12 people.
Every single one of them.
12 people on the jury did. Okay? And I wasn't on the jury and you weren't on the jury. The investigation stuff that you have, it's almost like armchair quarterback. I'm not saying this kid's telling the truth about everything. I don't know. I'm not inside his head. And I'm not speaking from his voice, but at the end of the day, and you say they get it wrong all the time, 12 people found him guilty of what, 45 and 48?
Five people's lives were ruined. People who lived exemplary lives had their reputations destroyed, had their lives ruined. One remains rotting away in prison. The media and the governor of the state lied to the people about what evidence they had, which created the perception amongst all of those jurors and everyone else in Center County, Pennsylvania, that this guy was a monster. He never had a chance. He had a novice, an unprepared, an unqualified lawyer who gave him terrible advice. And this thing was horribly played by Team Sandusky, but there's not a single one of these kids' stories, these kids, they're adults, that check out. They don't under scrutiny. So you go next to Jessica Dersham, who was the woman at Child Youth Services, declared the complaint that came not from Aaron Fisher, but from his mother, that Sandusky had abused him. Fisher told Dersham he had never been touched by Sandusky. He told the cop, Kavanaugh, that testified that he had never been touched by Sandusky. Yet she decides that she has a gut feeling that something's wrong here. I would submit to you something was wrong. And Aaron Fisher was abused. He was abused by his stepfather that went to prison, pled guilty on 100 counts of child abuse. He wasn't abused by Jerry Sandusky, which is why he couldn't testify in front of the grand jury, which is why they were so scared about him as a witness. They knew that he liked Jerry. They knew what a difference Jerry had made his life in giving him a shot. And they were so worried that he would fall apart and not be able to do what he was being asked to do. And if you look at that story of his and how absurd the Hilton Garden Inn thing is, and it going from abuse to one time, then to 100 times, it makes, and by the way, we'll find out that that 100 times crosses with two others who claim hundreds of times over the same time period, all who say it occurred on weekends at Sandusky's house. So Sandusky was bringing them in by the truckload into his house to abuse him every weekend. Yet these kids didn't know each other, had never heard of each other, even though they were abused hundreds of times at Sandusky's home over the same period of time. Come on. I won't go into, you know, how absurd the whole McQueary thing is. We've talked about it ad nauseum, but McQueary lies on the stand and gets caught lying on the stand when he claims that he went to the police because he's trying to cover his own ass and make it look like he did something about what he supposedly saw. So he goes and says that he talked to Gary Schultz and he thought Gary Schultz was the police. And the reason he thought Gary Schultz was the police is because he saw Gary Schultz during the campus riots on a walkie-talkie and working in conjunction with campus police. Well, he did. He saw that in March of 2001, which is a month after the date that he claims that he saw what he saw in the Penn State shower. And so he just plain lied about what he saw. And then again, the prosecutors lied, claiming that victim two's identity was, quote, known only to God, when they knew damn well who he was, and they brought him to a cabin in the middle of the woods to make sure he wouldn't show up and somehow get on the stand.
A lot of this, I mean, is the cabin thing. We talked about that. We talked about McQuarrie. We talked about all, you know, all of this. And we'll pick it up next week where we're supposed to, you know, because we got a whole lot more shit that is supposed to be covered today. But just because Ivana came back right then and said, you know, I said about the cabin on the last episode, but how do you know that they put him in the cabin? I mean, it's going to be back and forth, back and forth. I understand you vehemently believe what you believe, but just like some of the, you know, raping the kid in the pool with the glass all the way around and it's stupid as fuck. I get that. But some of this shit that you believe is just, to me, it's just as stupid as that. Now, I'm not calling you stupid. I'm saying that you're whatever bias on the side of it. But I mean, anyway, let's try to end it on a good, peaceful note to be continued next week, if you don't mind.
No, I'm fine with that, Woody. I'm not trying to fight with you, but I think you're fighting so hard at things that if you weren't playing that role as a detective, I think you are playing devil's advocate on stuff, and that as the great detective you are, and I know you would find a lot of this.
I find a lot of it very question, but it doesn't mean that it's all fucking not true, Mike.
Folks, Woody's about to jump through the computer and choke me. So we need to take a break. We'll stop it here and pick it back up next week. And we will talk back to you then. Yep. I'm sorry.
Love and appreciate each and every one of y'all. Love you, Ago. Thanks for the
you too, man.
Verbal judo or mental judo. Y'all be good to each other. Love one another and all that good shit. Peace.
All right. Go hug that grandbaby.
I will, bro. All
right. Aglets. Bye.